from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. For our last show of 2012, we're revisiting a few of our interviews with some of the most interesting people we've talked to this year. We'll start with my chat with author John Green.
Then we'll hear my interview with the Indianapolis Museum of Art's new director, Charles Venimal.
Then I'll wrap things up with my recent talk with singer Michael Feinstein. Plus, there'll be our Arts Calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Author John Green has had a terrific year. His book, The Fault in Our Stars, has been on the New York Times bestseller list, is on about every critic's top 10 list for young adult fiction, and he just received the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award. Travis DiNicola spoke with John Green about his work.
So I got to say, I am really thrilled this year that the Indiana Authors Award selected you as the national winner, Barb Shoup as the regional, and Dan Wakefield as the Lifetime Achievement Award winner. Now with having you on Art of the Matter in the past month, we've had all three of you on. Dan has been on as well as Barb. And also I think what's really cool is at Indie Reads Books, which is what I'm doing when I'm not on Art of the Matter, we've had all three of you for readings at the bookstore this year. And I think it's great, and it's been really cool to help celebrate the Indiana Authors Awards with the three of you this year. I want to start out by just asking you what it means to you to be honored in this way. We're recording it right before the awards ceremony happens and airing it afterwards, and so congratulations. But what's this mean to you to be honored in this way?
Oh, it means a lot. I mean, it means a lot coming from my hometown. This place has really become home to my family and me, and so it's a tremendous honor. It's also an honor to be acknowledged alongside writers I really admire, like Barb and Dan. So it's really a thrill.
Cool. Well, I know a lot of people were very excited when you moved back, and this is a great recognition of that. You have become your own brand, and are really both complex and interesting one, I find, as an author. I mean, when we had you for the opening of Indie Reads Books, there were 400 very well-behaved teenage girls there with their books in hand, which was kind of a really exciting thing to see. I mean, that many young people with physical books wanting to, celebrate literacy with you. And that's, I mean, you've got such a great appeal with young kids, but it goes beyond the books. It's, I mean, what you're doing online with your blogs, numerous websites. Do you feel a little, multi-personality with all your different brands?
Well, I mean,
schizophrenic,
I see it all as part of the same, same endeavor in a lot of ways, because, I'm trying to talk about stuff that I find interesting with people I find interesting. And a lot of times that takes the form of novels, which for me is the place where I can have sort of in-depth conversations, both as a reader and a writer. That's a place where I can go to have quiet, contemplative time, kind of alone, or at least alone with one other person, the author. Mm-hmm. But it's also really important to me to reach out to the places where people are, not just to the places where maybe I wish they would be, but the places where they are, and they are on Twitter, and they are on Tumblr, and they are on Facebook. And so that's important to me. And I think because I grew up with the internet, it's just always been a part of my life. And I don't see it as separate from my writing work, really. I see it as part of it.
Tell me about Nerdfighters, because that's a big part of your online work that you're doing, and online personality.
Yeah, the community of people who watch the videos that my brother and I make are called Nerdfighters, because they fight for nerd culture and intellectualism and just generally celebrate nerdiness. It's been a huge part of my life, and I have so much admiration for these young people who are excited and enthusiastic, because really, I mean, when we criticize people for being nerds, what we're actually saying is you are getting too excited about something. You are geeking out, as we say. I think it's great to geek out. I think it's great to be excited. I love to see passion. I mean, we're only at least so far as we know, we're only here just the once. Like, are we going to spend that time reveling in ironic detachment, or are we going to spend that time marveling at the miracle of human consciousness? And Nerdfighters remind me every day that that it's a real privilege to be here, a real privilege to be able to observe the universe, and it is something that we should get excited about.
And passionate about, and enthusiastic about. And it doesn't have anything, even though, I mean, a lot of your reach is, you know, through your books and through the work you do online with young adults, it's not limited to that at all.
No. In fact, like, most of the people who watch our videos are over 18.
Yeah.
And frankly, these days, most of the people who read my books are over 18, too. I mean, The Fault in Our Stars is read primarily by adults. But yeah, I mean, to me, it's you know, in all of my work, I want to reach the broadest possible audience.
You mentioned your brother. You two do a lot of video work together. You kind of were famous for the video communication that you had with each other over a couple years a year back. Tell me a bit about that, working with your brother on things like this.
Well, we started making videos back and forth to each other in 2007 when YouTube was still kind of a new thing. And we thought that we were only going to do it for a year. But our audience grew very large, and we felt a responsibility to the audience, I guess. And so we kept making videos. In fact, we just made
And you were making videos in lieu of sending each other emails?
Right, yeah. And we'd given up all textual communication, and
we're
communicating.
Which is a weird thing for an author to do.
Well, it is, but I also feel like text, particularly between friends or family members, can be a way of sort of insulating yourself from intimacy. And so I wanted to be seeing my brother and talking to him, because he lives in Montana and we don't see each other very often. So I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to have that feeling of close interaction again that I hadn't had since we were little kids. But yeah, I mean, obviously I do like text. I'm a fan of it, but so we did that for a year, and then, and then that just sort of kept going, and we just made our 1,000th video, and I mean, we just passed 250 million video views, so it's been 6 crazy years.
I was just watching a video that recently posted, the title, I think it was roughly, Why Corporations Don't Have to Suck. Is that close?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay, tell me a bit about this one.
Well, a few years ago, my brother started a record label for YouTube musicians to sort of restructure the deals that musicians traditionally get, so that they would basically, his company basically does the distribution, the artists themselves, who are already doing all their own promotion and marketing, get the vast majority of the sales from each album. And this has worked really well, but then they've also expanded into many other kinds of businesses. And the argument that I wanted to make in the video is that when you make a business that's focused on filling a need, and making a reasonable profit, that the economy isn't a zero-sum game, that, like, you know, we can grow the entire size of the economy, and that's ultimately how jobs are created and things like that. So the idea, and we all have this idea that, like, while we like the things that corporations make, we find the corporations themselves a little bit icky. And there are some good reasons.
You reference iPods and Dr. Pepper.
Right, yeah. We like iPods and Dr. Pepper, but we don't necessarily like Apple or PepsiCo or I actually don't know who makes Dr. Pepper. It might be independent. But we don't, you know, I wanted to, you know, to argue that within this post-industrialization capitalism, there is, you know, there is within that some kinds of businesses to actually celebrate.
Do you ever, I mean, it's got to be an interesting balance that, and I don't know how intentional you are in maintaining it in terms of both. The fact that you're speaking out on things like this is exciting to your fans, but there's also always that risk of alienating some of your fans. I mean, I saw one time, I don't even remember what it was, but a couple of weeks ago you had posted something on Facebook that was somewhat political, and people were like, oh, John Green's being political. You know, I mean, it's...
Yeah. It wasn't that political. yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm pretty... I can't not be myself.
Yeah.
And I don't really feel an obligation to be someone other than myself, and I also think that because I do espouse a kind of political centrism that's a bit out of fashion at the moment of our celebration of ideological rigidity, I do feel a bit of a responsibility to stand up as one of those voices of just hey, let's meet in the middle. Mm-hmm. You know, the old-fashioned American idea of compromise. So I guess I do feel a responsibility to do that. But I also, on Twitter and Facebook and Tumblr, I am myself. And it doesn't really do me any good not to be myself.
Right, right. But in terms of that responsibility, I mean, does it cross your mind that, you know, as you said, I mean, you've got more perhaps readers now that are over 18, but so much of your fan base is, you know, teenage girls and boys, 14, 15, 16 years old, who are following you, who are reading this stuff, and, you know, some people could say, oh, is he influencing them in a positive manner? I mean, what sort of, I mean, responsibility do you feel towards that?
Well, I think it's a real privilege to have a seat at the table in the lives of young people when they're forming their values and when they're deciding what matters most to them, what's important to them. When they're grappling with these big, interesting philosophical questions of human existence for the first time, that's a real privilege, and it's one that I try to take very seriously, both in my novels and in my online work. At the same time, I try always to encourage people to disagree with me, mm-hmm. and not to assume that I'm right. And in fact, you know, I try to always say that I might be wrong and that I've been wrong before, and then in fact I'm often wrong, and that, like, it's okay to change your mind, and that it, you know, that value formation process is not a monolithic event. It's a process that goes on for your entire life, and it's okay to change and grow
and explore and
yeah
absolutely. And maybe make some mistakes along the way.
Absolutely.
Almost certainly. Let's talk a bit about your work. I mean, your newest book, The Fault in Our Stars, has been a New York Times bestseller, has had amazing reviews. Congratulations.
Thanks.
On that. The book is set here in Indianapolis. Tell me a bit about it.
Yeah, it's about two kids, Hazel and Augustus, who meet at a support group for teenagers with cancer. And Hazel has stage 4 thyroid cancer and has been sick and terminally sick for quite a while. Augustus is in remission from a bone cancer. And they meet and they kind of share a love for a book that was written by an author who now lives in seclusion in Amsterdam. And they really want to meet this author and ask him what happens after the end of his book, which has a very sort of ambiguous, annoyingly ambiguous ending. And so it's really the story of their sort of emergent love together, and also their love of this book. But it is, yeah, it's set here in Indianapolis. So, like, from the Indianapolis Museum of Art to the Speedway at 86th and Ditch, there are lots of familiar places.
So you've been back in Indy now for, what, about 4 years or so?
5 years.
Five years. And what is it like being, you know, an author living here? I mean, I know you certainly travel for your work quite a bit, but this is home.
This is home, and I love this city, and I think it's a great city for an American writer to live in because it's such an American city, in both the best ways and the most challenging ways. You know, I think that the people here are uncommonly generous and hardworking, and I believe that ultimately a place is its people, and that's why I love Indianapolis, is because I love my friends here, and, you know, we've grown to have such great relationships with our friends and neighbors here, mm-hmm. and I can't imagine ever living anywhere else. But it also embodies America in the sense of chain restaurants. I mean, this is where, if you want to start a new chain restaurant, this is your test market, because it's so American. It's so, and I think so. If I'm going to be writing about America, it feels very right to me to mm-hmm. be living here in a place that resembles, in so many important ways, and that symbolizes in so many important ways, both what I love and what I struggle with about contemporary America. So it's the perfect place for me, but I also just really like living here. I love biking around the city. I love driving my car. I'm an American in that sense. So, you know, it's great. I really love it here.
So can you share with us a bit about what you're working on now?
I'm not working on much at the moment. This book has sort of taken over my life, which is great. That's obviously a wonderful thing to have happen to you, but it makes it difficult to write. But I'm just starting to research a new book, parts of which are set here. So we'll see.
So, John, let me ask you one last question. For your fans out there that are listening right now, what book would you recommend to them to read while they're waiting for your next one?
Well, they're going to have to read a bunch. I just read a wonderful young adult novel that also is a great read for adults called Every Day by David Levithan, which is about a person with no gender or body who wakes up each day in the body of a different person and spends one day inside that person's body, sort of possessing them, essentially. It's a really, really interesting novel. It's that rare novel that has a great premise that also pulls off the premise really interestingly. So yeah, I'd recommend Every Day.
Very cool. John Green, it's great to have you on Art of the Matter. And again, congratulations for being the national winner of the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award this year. It's a great honor and it's well deserved.
Oh, thanks very much, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with author John Green. You can learn more at johngreenbooks.com. johngreenbooks.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
After a national search to replace Maxwell Anderson, the Indianapolis Museum of Art hired Dr. Charles Venable as its Melvin and Bren Simon Director and CEO. Though he was raised in Texas, Venable came to the IMA from 5 years at Louisville's Speed Museum and 5 years before that at the Cleveland Museum of Art, so he's become a Midwesterner. Sharon Gamble invited him to our studios to find out what he thinks now that he's settled in a bit.
I have the sense that you've become a Midwesterner.
True.
You've kind of been on the Midwest tour with Cleveland and Louisville. Is there a perceptible difference between working in an art museum environment in, say, Dallas as opposed to the Midwest? I know some people consider Dallas Midwest. So
I would be on the side that considers Dallas quite Midwestern. It has a veneer that might glitter a little more from an outside sort of stereotypical point of view. However, when you live there, it's very Midwestern. It was founded by Midwesterners when the train came through and the city was laid out by a guy from Kansas City. And so Houston, the difference between Dallas and Houston is much greater because Houston is much more sort of like New Orleans, a big port city, much more sort of rough and tumble. Dallas is very organized, just like Indianapolis or Cleveland or Chicago.
Very organized. Say more about that.
Well, in terms of, you know, I grew up in Houston. There's no zoning in Houston at all. You know, you could have somebody could build a hospital next to your mother's house on the other side of it. The freeway could be built. So
what a free-for-all.
It is a free-for-all, which would be my point, I suppose. You know, often you get in cities on the water that have big ports, lots of transit people coming and going. Very different than inland cities that were, you know, had to be more organized in a way. Not all of these cities were really meant to exist out sort of in the middle of the prairies.
Including Indianapolis.
Indianapolis, Dallas too. There's no reason whatsoever that Dallas should exist. It was really people willing a city into existence, and to do that you often have to be organized planners and really think about short-term and long-term benefits and how are you going to run a city and organize it? And the museums are no different than that. Most museums in the Midwest, you know, the trustees are very often very businesslike. They very much want things done in the right order. They want you to, you know, respect the endowment. They want you to sort of do things that would make sure that the museum's there 50 years as well as 100 years from now.
You know, it also makes for the fact of not being sort of naturally, organically located on, say, navigable water or some other great natural resource. Makes for a bit of a marketing and PR challenge, doesn't it?
It does, indeed. Now, that said, I guess since all of our great cities were founded, those that were on rivers still have rivers, but places like Indianapolis now have major superhighways, which are as much, probably more important in the world of commerce now than river traffic is. So Indianapolis, one of the things that I very much like and hope to exploit, I guess I would be so bold to say, is the location in the center of much of the United States with a 2 to 3 mile an hour radius around us in terms of driving, which is a catchment of millions and millions and millions of people.
Absolutely.
And I would think that a great institution like the IMA, if we had the right kind of shows and did the right kind of marketing, I would think we would be able to do I guess I would say better in terms of becoming more of a regional travel hub, getting some people from Chicago, people from Cincinnati, Louisville, Dayton, St. Louis, a little far, but nevertheless, for a long weekend, I could easily imagine people coming here for the right types of exhibitions.
We're easy to get to. We have a growing list of amenities that you can come in and stay in good hotels, eat in good places after you've been through those exhibitions.
Sure, or before.
Or before, that's right. Extend your weekend. So what drew you to art in the first place?
Oh, how funny. It's a great question. I'm the middle of three boys, and I think if you had my mother here, she would say, well, he was always the artsy child.
What did that look like when
well,
you were
it
a
meant
child?
That Charles was the one who loved craft projects. I was in the, you know, everything from the Boy Scouts to the or Cub Scouts, really more when you do those kind of things. And different types of school classes. Always loved art in school. Took paintings lessons when I was in the seventh grade. Can you imagine that? With my art teacher from junior high school and things like that. So I was unlike my younger brother who was more into sports and cars and all those kind of things.
And the older one?
The older one is kind of in the middle, I suppose. They both still live in Houston and work for my parents' company down there. I'm the child who escaped.
What does your parents' company do?
They manufacture awnings like for your house or other things made out of industrial fabrics.
And you said, I'm going somewhere else. I'm doing
something
else.
Yes. Well, I went to Rice University in Houston and graduated with a degree in art history and American history, and then went off to graduate school on the East Coast and eventually made my way back to Texas, but a different city, went to Dallas for 16 years.
Anybody else in your family artistic? I mean, where did this come from?
Not so much. One of my grandmothers liked this, liked art and liked making things with her hands, I think. So I came to art, as you would note in an art museum, really from kind of a craft background. I love to know how things are made. It's why I probably started out being a specialist in furniture and silver and ceramics.
The decorative arts, yeah.
Because I love the techniques of how do you make all that stuff, as much as the industrialized factory production of things like china that we think is so precious, but, factories spit that stuff out in just quantities, huge quantities, all the way down to handcrafted things, which most people think a little bit more when they think of a museum.
What do you collect personally?
Contemporary photography, as well as some contemporary painting, a few older things. But then because I was a design curator, lots of objets, if you're going to be kind, to all the stuff that we have in my office or in our house. Yeah.
Wait, does your partner say, we have too much stuff?
Oh, he would say, oh, my God, it's an obsession. We've got to get rid of some of this stuff. Yes, very, very much so. So actually my office now at the IMA, since I kept my research library over at the house, the bookshelves now have porcelain objects on them.
What of?
Oh, they're mainly ceramics, like teawares, teapots, coffee pots, stuff like that we've. And they're all white, which is even more obsessive, I suppose. But I think if you like to collect things, you have to limit yourself somehow. Or
you
else
absolutely
you
could, do.
You just go wild collecting all very randomly. So the more you focus, I think often you get more and more knowledge about that specific area you're interested in, and therefore you end up having better things.
You get more selective. And also at antique shows, say, or auctions, you get this laser-like vision if you only collect, this color of this kind of pottery or whatever it is.
Right.
Yeah. So, big picture question. What is the role of an art museum, and is it different now than it was in the past?
Well, it's interesting because I think in a way we might be coming sort of full circle. If you look back at art museums early in the 20th century, like the IMA was founded in 1883, so it's been around a very, well over 100 years. Early on, while museums were trying to build collections, it wasn't so focused on the amount of art you had. It was not obsessively about collecting art. It was very much about civic engagement and often doing art classes. Here, the Heron School and the IMA were the same thing. They grew out of the same organization. And then museums became, I guess you would say, sort of more sophisticated as institutions, and they began being more systematic about collecting art and about doing certain types of exhibitions. And that's served institutions quite well. But now, how much art do you actually need is a question being asked by a lot of people in order to achieve your mission, to do certain types of teaching, to do certain types of things that the public wants to be engaged with. So that when you think that art museums have only, you know, almost invariably less than 10, and many museums have 2 and 3% of their collections on view at any one time. And having large stockpiles of art, if you will, do cost a lot of money to maintain and secure and do conservation, and you build warehouses for them, and they have high security around them. And so make it's not to me, it's not so much about how much art you have, it's really about how good is the art, how much does it sort of speak to the public, is it memorable, I guess is one thing that I would charge all visitors to be, you know, how memorable is the art that they see on the wall.
What percent at any given time is on view of the IMA's collection?
Oh, I'd actually, I guess after 4 weeks.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm really putting you on
know
the
that,
spot
but
here.
It's probably 5%.
It's minimal.
Or less.
Yeah.
There's 57,000 works in the collection. So even though it's a very big museum, when you actually go along and say, you know, there are not 10 paintings in every square inch, there's, you know, 10 paintings in a gallery. Out of 57,000, it's a small percentage, which is true of virtually every museum in the world.
And there's a kind of an interesting, complex, organic relationship between the funders and community around a museum and mm-hmm. the collections the museum has acquired and can acquire and might want to acquire in the future.
Correct. I mean, unlike European museums, for the most part, which often start out of royal collections, so they started like the top point of the pyramid in terms of society, and then the government took those over as they often dismantled monarchies and came into possession of the art collections. Here, of course, art museums, just like the IMA, grew out of volunteer associations, often of women, actually, in the late 19th century, who got together and founded art organizations, and then they sort of turned into art museums. And so we still have a very close relationship with the community, with our governors and our trustees. They're all unpaid volunteers, and they're really responsible for making sure that the museum has the wherewithal to do the public service that we do and the kinds of educational activities that we do. And so American museums are almost unique in having this giant volunteer basis of support. And very, very little state or city or federal funding.
Do you feel like the schools, and I know you've only been here a month, so this is a bigger picture question about American education in general, are the schools staying up to the level they need to with visual art education, or do you think have you seen a change in your couple of decades or so?
Well, I do think most people, unfortunately, I guess I would say, are sort of visually illiterate. You know, we spend an enormous amount of time making sure people read well and sort of do mathematics in a certain way. But your brain also functions by what you see and what you hear and how it processes information that doesn't come from the written word or from deciphering numerals on a page in a certain order. And that's something that America, our school system, doesn't deal with very well. And as budgets have been cut over the last decade, certainly taking out art and music, even though art and music for some children is the way that they learn the most in terms of processing information. Not everybody is in a linear sort of thinker. And so
thank goodness,
exactly, if we want the world to continue to be an interesting creative place, and particularly in an international global economy, which we certainly now live in, we want plenty of people who live in this country to really be the most creative people they can be. And art and music, no matter how you define that broad term, is one of the main pillars that support that kind of creative education that we must figure out a way not to neglect it in this country. We've almost abandoned it in public schools.
And what's curious is that given the amount of time people spend connected online in one way mm-hmm. or another, most of what you're connected to on the internet is visually driven.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Totally. People are spending thousands of hours a week practically looking at visual information, and it's not presented to them in any linear way. It's a very free-flowing world out there, and so that's very different than the way we learn to process information in a rote way or from reading, where you start on page one and you end up on page 100. You know, that's not the way the internet works at all when you start gathering information that way. It's very non-linear. And actually, art museums, the way they present the world to you in terms of art and our programs, can, if you want it to be, also a very non-linear experience that matches actually the modern world of the internet.
Sharon Gamble with Dr. Charles Venable, the Indianapolis Museum of Art's Melvin and Bren Simon Director and CEO.
Oh, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
What have you resolved for 2013?
To see more art, see more theater, more local, and hear more music, right?
I love that.
Go to more dance.
Go to more dance. I'm going to try a dance class. I'm thinking about learning the tango.
Oh, that's a great idea.
As if it isn't hard enough, right?
But... okay. Well, you know, I will. That's a great idea for 2013. I will match you, and I am going to practice guitar.
Fantastic.
That's my resolution.
I love it. And dear listeners, we hope you are resolving to include more local arts in your lives. And we'll be back for our first show of the new year with that calendar we call
What'll We Do in 2013. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Singer, pianist, and music historian Michael Feinstein was just 20 years old when he got the opportunity to work for Ira Gershwin. Feinstein's new book is about the 6 years working as Gershwin's archivist, but it's also a history of the Gershwin brothers' contribution to the Great American Songbook, as told through 12 songs. Travis DiNicola spoke with Feinstein, who's also the artistic director of the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel, about his new book.
Michael, welcome to Art of the Matter. It is truly a pleasure to have you in our studio.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And congratulations on the new book. Absolutely beautiful. Obviously, a work of love.
Yes, I'm very pleased with the way it turned out. It is, in its own way, lavish. It was fun to be involved in choosing all the different kinds of images and the color and the kind of paper stock mm-hmm. to create something that would be appropriate for the era in which... I've written about the Gershwins.
A great gift for music lovers, I would think. Just a really lovely book that you've put together. But let me ask you this. I mean, there's so many wonderful stories, and of course they're organized around the 12 different songs that you've selected. But how did you first get connected with Ira Gershwin? You were 20 years old, is that right? When you
yes.
first met him or started working with him?
Yes, I was 20. I'd moved to Los Angeles from Columbus, Ohio, mm-hmm. and I was trying to find my way as a performer, and I also was a record collector, and I went into a used record store in Hollywood called The Record Collector and was looking for a record by Oscar Levant. The guy who owned the shop had these records that belonged to Levant that had come from an auction of the Levant estate. I bought the records, and then I got the phone number of his widow, whom I called out of the blue, and she was sort of perplexed by this call from this kid, and I went over to
sure.
meet her, and she eventually created an introduction to the Gershwin family after she and I had become friends. So it was quite an amazing sort of circuitous journey that now seems like it was supposed to happen.
I mean, obviously, over the years that you worked with Ira Gershwin, you developed a very close friendship, but meeting him that first time, I mean, that had to be just a little overwhelming for a young kid.
I was very nervous. Ira Gershwin was one of my idols. I was 20. He was 80. He had written the words to all these classic songs that I had grown up with, and it was amazing that he was still alive because mm-hmm. most of his contemporaries were gone. His brother George died in 1937 at the age of 38. So there I was with this man who I only had read about and I'd seen photos of, and mm-hmm. he was much older than the photos I'd seen of him because he had become reclusive, and suddenly there I was trying to make conversation with him, and I said, Mr. Gershwin, I have a old 78 of Gems from La La Lucille. La La Lucille was the first Broadway musical written by George Gershwin mm-hmm. in 1919. I said, La La Lucille? He said, well, that must contain the two hits of the show, Teotolo Mbumbo and Nobody But You. I said, that's right. And his wife, Lee, turned to her sister, who was also sitting there, and said, isn't that cute? He's telling Ira that's right.
Oh, how funny.
It started a relationship immediately that Ira saw that I was not your typical kid of that generation.
Sure.
And it was a magnificent experience.
And you basically, over the time, got to work with cataloging his his records, his memorabilia. Is that, I mean, roughly correct? Or I mean, yes. You did a lot of different work for him over those, I believe it was 6 years, correct?
6 years and 1 month. The first job was to catalog his collection of phonograph records.
Okay.
And as I was doing that, I became more or better acquainted with Ira. He would sit there as I'd go through the records and play them, which would spur his memory to tell me stories and anecdotes. And we became very close very, very quickly. And one day his wife, Lee, came to me and said, "You've given my husband a new lease on life, and I want you to know that you're very important to this household and to him." And she said, "I want you to stay here as long as you can." She said, "I'm going to open up every closet and drawer to just keep yourself busy, and most important, keep my husband happy."
Wow.
So there I was, basically, with the purpose of keeping Ira connected and happy and alive. And it was great for me because I got to go through all the memorabilia in the house, everything, and he would tell me stories about all of it. And to have physical objects to spur the trigger of the memory was amazing because it caused him to recall things that otherwise he might never have been able to think of.
Now, were you taking notes at the time yourself? I mean, were you thinking this is just, you know, of course you're cataloging some great physical artifacts of history, but the stories that he's telling, were you consciously thinking, I need to get this down?
I kept notes at certain times, and I wish that I had kept more copious notes.
Sure.
Shana Alexander, who was a wonderful author and whose father was a songwriter and close friend of the Gershwins, said, "Oh, you've got to keep a diary." Mm-hmm. And foolishly, I didn't listen and keep a regular diary. However, there were times where I did record sessions with Ira when we would go through music, and when I brought the great songwriter Harry Warren over to see Ira, I recorded that for some reason. So there's a lot of memorabilia and recordings and such that I was able to go back to help me create my book.
Well, there's a lot of moments in the book where it feels like you're right there in the room with you and Ira. I mean, it's really enjoyable to read. I got to say that the chapter that I think I probably enjoyed the most, I've been just loving reading the book, is the one on I've Got a Crush on You. I love that song anyway. And you tie it in so nicely at the time period with Rhapsody in Blue. And so much of the chapter is, in fact, about Rhapsody in Blue and then sort of and other songs of that time period. Tell me a bit about that, because that's, of course, I mean, when people hear of the Gershwins, that's Rhapsody in Blue is one of the first things they think of.
Yes, well, Rhapsody in Blue was written as a piece of special material, if you will, for the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. Paul Whiteman gave an interview to a New York newspaper saying that he had this concert coming up, and he said, "Oh, Irving Berlin's writing a piece for us, and George Gershwin's going to write a piece." Neither of which was true. And George Gershwin read this in the paper and called up Whiteman and said, "What are you talking about?" And Whiteman said, "Well, yeah, I told you someday I'd like you to write something." He said, "Why don't you just write it?" So George said, "Okay, well, I'll give it a shot." So it was that casual. And George wrote this piece over a period of 3.5 weeks, which was very quickly orchestrated by Ferdy Groffé, who was Paul Whiteman's orchestrator. And on February 12, 1924, it was part of this concert at Aeolian Hall called An Experiment in Modern Music.
Okay.
And the piece was premiered, and among all the other works in this very, very long concert, Rhapsody was second from the end. It created this this furor that was unprecedented, and the concert was attended by everyone from Rachmaninoff to Heifetz and all the important musicians of the day. And suddenly, this piece that was written as a specialty for the Paul Whiteman dance band became the shot heard around the world.
Hmm.
And shortly thereafter, the concert was repeated at Carnegie Hall and a dozen times after that. And then George's publisher, who published all his popular songs, decided to publish it. And when George told Ira that they were going to publish Rhapsody in Blue, Ira said, well, who's going to buy it? Because it was such an odd thing. It was a 15-minute piece for piano and orchestra. I mean, who was going to play that? But, of course, it turned out to be the most popular piece of American music written in the 20th century.
You know, just listening to you right now, I said that it was, sometimes in reading the book, it was like sitting in the room with you and Ira. It's almost like sitting in the room with you and George, if that was possible. I mean, you almost kind of transport yourself back to that time period through Ira's stories. It's as if you were actually back there during the 20s and 30s and such. I mean, that's one of the really enjoyable things about the book. I mean, did you, you know, feel that at times, like that you were almost like time traveling in your conversations with Ira Gershwin?
Well, my whole life feels like that. It does. Yeah. I mean, because I live a duality of being in the present, but also experiencing other time I guess it's that whole physics thing where you know, time is is everything's happening at once. Yes, it definitely felt like I was in Ira's era, especially because all the artifacts were there still. George's pipe and his tie clip and his little black book with the phone numbers of his girlfriends and his paintings and of course all the working materials. And so it all had an energy and an aura, and to be able to hold a manuscript that was in George's hand and then to find Ira's lyric sheet really gave me a sense of immediacy. And the piano that I practiced on every day there was the piano on which George had written Rhapsody, written Porgy and Bess. Rhapsody, that piano had, well, there are probably about 25 people I've met through the years who claim to have the piano on which he wrote Rhapsody and Blues, so I don't know where that real one is.
Now, my understanding is you've always been a collector, Michael Feinstein. You've always loved collecting the memorabilia of the music that you love, of the American Songbook. At what point did you start thinking about that this collection had a purpose? And I'm jumping ahead a bit here to the work that you do through the Center of the Performing Arts, Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel, and the work you do there with the American Songbook Collection. But, I mean, were you thinking before you had worked with Ira Gershwin or while you were doing that, you know, maybe someday this stuff will all be brought together in some sort of, you know, exhibit or collection? Or at what point did that occur to you, that you'd really tapped into something special?
I'll tell you, Travis, the funny thing is that a lot of the stuff that I collected early on, I didn't keep. I had an original contract from Porgy and Bess, which I donated to the Library of Congress very early on, then to discover they already had a copy of it, which was sort of irritating. But I had a huge amount of very rare studio records, Hollywood records, that I also gave to an institution. It wasn't until a number of years after Ira died that I started holding on to things, because I realized that I didn't like what had happened with some of the things that I had passed on to others, and I wanted to make sure that what I had could be appreciated and would be in a situation where others could benefit from it in one way or another. And so I'd say the last 20 years is where I started to really focus on it. As time has progressed, more and more so, and as I have collected more and more material and then orchestrations and things that take up a great amount of space, then I realized that I needed to find a place or create a place, which I did. I created the Feinstein Initiative, which is headquartered in Carmel at the upstairs offices of the Palladium, because I wanted to finally get the stuff out there so other people could experience it.
Tell me a little bit more about your work here in Indiana, in Carmel, with the center. It was very exciting when it was announced that you were going to be the artistic director. It seems like certainly a big part of the appeal was that you could bring your American Songbook collection here. But there's so many other things that you seem to have going on in town. And you've really, and I know you live between here and New York and L.A., but it seems like you've really made Carmel and Indianapolis part of your life and your home.
Yes, well, this is where I'm registered to vote.
Okay.
This is home. And the thing that's great about this part of the world, as you know, being involved in the arts, is that there's a certain openness and an appreciation that exists in this community that is unusual to this area. I mean, the fact that Indianapolis has such a thriving arts community, and the city of Carmel, which has created the money to build the Palladium, is rather extraordinary. I mean, there is a great emphasis on the arts, and to give the Palladium an identity connected with the Great American Songbook, I think was a very good idea, because it meant it wasn't just another concert hall, even though what we present there is quite eclectic, and all the different series are wide-ranging with all the
recently I saw Blondie and Devo there.
Exactly.
I mean, who would have thunk that? But.
Yes, and it's fun for me to be able to book acts like that, because I like being on the other side of the process. But the preservation of the songbook, of course, is one of the main focuses, and so having the initiative offices here, I've been able to use the incredible Palladium to have the Great American Songbook competition, and in November we have new applicants from high schools and high school kids all over the country. So having this extraordinary state-of-the-art performing space and the support of the community and the staff is something that is a dream come true. I wouldn't be able to do what I do if it weren't for the people here.
It's really great that it seems like you've gotten a lot out of it and have brought so much as well. Tell me a bit about the radio show that you're doing. It just started airing here on WFYI just in the past month. Thrilled that that is on the air. Had you been doing that a while, or is that a new show? I wasn't clear on that.
Song Travels is something that was just created within the last year.
Okay.
We've had our first season, and the second season will start next year. It will be aired next year, and it will eventually be a weekly show that will be on 52 weeks a year, which means that I'm in the studio a great deal of
time. Keeping busy.
Yes, because Song Travels is a show that is 50% music and 50% talk, and the music is often live performances by our guests, which is the distinction of this program, that I wanted to have artists come and play music live. And some are comfortable doing that, some are not. And in many cases, I'm accompanying the performers or singing duets with them or doing whatever is appropriate for the show.
Yeah.
So it's a great musical challenge for me, and it involves tremendous preparation because I've got to be on my game where I'll get a list of songs just a couple nights before from Jose Feliciano or Gloria Gaynor or whoever saying, I want to do this and that, and I have to practice it and I have to be ready. You know, with Aaron Neville, I was doing these doo-wop songs, and I've done gospel things, and it's been exciting to stretch myself in these other genres because that's the joy of it for me.
That is very exciting, and it is quite a great range, and it sounds like you're just having a fun time with it.
I am. I'm always grateful when it's finished and it's worked out well because it's a lot of pressure. But it has to sound very, but it's also relaxed and fun, so it's that balance.
You know, I want to go back to something you said in the book, and not to change the tone of the conversation too much, but I was a little surprised. And one point near the end of the book, you talk about how that the culture for music and the appreciation of music is different now, and maybe not as strong as you feel like it used to be. Whether that time that it used to be back in the 20s or 30s, or even during the 60s and 70s. But yet, there's so many great musicians and so many different ways of hearing them today. Tell me about what you were thinking when you wrote that in the book.
The communal experience is different. We listen to music in an isolated fashion.
Mm-hmm.
People listen on their iPods. People listen with earphones in their ears. You see people walking down the street and they're no longer engaged in the world because they are lost in their own world listening to music. And that is very different from the communal experience that existed when our country was transformed by particular songs or experiences that music would carry us through. It's an experience that does not exist today.
That shared experience.
The shared experience is different.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have too many songs that everybody knows. Certain people know pop stuff, there's classical, but it is all segmented and fragmented in a way that is the gift of the world today, that people can find any genre they're interested in, but people tend to focus on one thing, and the shared experience is less. Just like with news outlets today, you know, people gravitate to the news outlets that reflect their specific point of view, so we are becoming narrower in our ability to appreciate other points of view. It's the same thing with music.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's the unfortunate part of the world today, that we are not forced to experience something communally, and I think that that is a tremendous loss. Now, I'm not denigrating music today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just talking about the means by which we are becoming more and more isolated from each other as humans, and we are losing the heart experience, and we are losing our common bond of coming together in a way that has separated us politically. I think that the deprivation and lack of arts funding over the last 30 years has directly impacted many of the travails we have in this country. It is so clear to me. And the fact that we have a political system where neither Republicans or Democrats really care about the arts is a tragedy. And when I say really care about the arts, then we don't have a cultural arts ambassador in our country. We don't have anybody that seems to be truly championing the need for arts, because the arts are truly what unify us as a country. And until these fools in the political system realize that we will destroy ourselves without that, we're going to remain in turmoil.
Am I also hearing you say, too, though, the importance of that communal, live, shared experience? as well. I mean, whether it's at a small club, your club in New York, or here at the Playdom, I mean, just bringing people together to experience that, even beyond just, you know, having sort of common themes that people share or common ideas, as you so eloquently put. I mean, that has something to do with it as well, doesn't it?
Yes, the power of coming together.
Yeah.
It's like the power of praying together or doing anything en masse. The power of people focusing on one thing is life-changing. When I do live concerts, it's my favorite thing,
mm-hmm.
because it is an experience where everybody is breathing together and everybody's hearts are open up in the same way, and it is transformative. It is a transformative experience that truly uplifts us and gives us hope and courage to do things in the world. When people leave a great artistic performance, be it ballet or an exhibition of paintings,
mm-hmm.
we feel more creative in our souls. It extends our lives. I mean, the physiological effects of what the arts do are extraordinary. And to see that devalued and unappreciated is just head-scratching to me.
Well, Michael, as a big fan of your live performances that I have seen, it is truly a pleasure to meet you in person and to speak with you live. And I thank you very much for your time today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with musician Michael Feinstein. Feinstein is the artistic director of the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel. Proceeds from the book The Gershwins and Me will benefit the Michael Feinstein Great American Songbook Initiative, which hosts the only high school vocal academy and competition in the U.S. dedicated solely to the music from Broadway, Hollywood musicals, and the Tin Pan Alley era of the early to mid-20th century. The book and CD can be purchased at the Center for the Performing Arts Basile Gift Shop and at Indie Reads Books. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next weekend, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7, when I'll find out about a new mural created as part of St. Vincent's Art Therapy Program.
I'll find out about the Indiana High School Architecture Design Competition.
And I'll chat with the actor playing Frankie Valli in the touring production of Jersey Boys.
So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.